I have
current geek.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Current Geek. This is Current Geek, the weekly proceedings of the meetings of the Frog Pants All Stars, geeks of the world, and you to keep you current on all things that matter most. I'm Scott Johnson. That is Tom Merritt.
It feels like it's been less than a week since we last did Current Geek.
Kind of has. Does. Time flies when you're not doing a show.
When you sleep a lot, time flies.
Yeah, I'm glad. You know what? You're feeling better. That's what counts. Yep. You had
fever's gone.
Yeah. Any residuals? You all right?
Heat is on.
Okay.
I still got a little bit of a cough since you asked, but okay. I'm not complaining.
All right. Well, he's a professional. That means he's got a cough switch. He knows how to use it and and abuse it. Also with us, we have a guest. I'm very excited about this. It was actually Tom's suggestion, and when he said it, I went, oh, yeah, of course. We should have him on. Ladies and gentlemen, it's Ben Howard on the line. Hello, Ben.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
It's good to have you. You could do a horror podcast. Tell people about that.
Yeah, I used to host a podcast for many years called Mondo Movie, and me and my cohort got back together recently and started a new show called Streampunk, which is a horror cult movie podcast looking at the weird and unusual movies you'll find on Netflix and Amazon Prime, but maybe aren't the ones on the front page.
Oh, that's fantastic. We tried to do similar things with old 80s movies, not necessarily horror movies, on our Film Sack show, and now I've got to hear this thing. It was Tom who suggested it, and I went, I didn't even know about it. I got to go listen to it, and I hope my listeners do as well, because that sounds like our kind of stuff.
Ben is also the king of gaming at CBS Interactive. Don't forget that.
Also amazing, and we'll have lots to talk about there.
Long-time colleagues, we've known each other, Mr. Merritt and I. But
yes, it's true.
Well, good.
Except Ben has stayed in the CBS.
I literally can't get out though, Tom. So.
Yeah, I know.
We're all very jealous that you managed to find the escape door. So, yeah, you know,
the hatch, we like to call it. All right,
follow the crumbs.
let's dive right into the headlines and talk about some of this stuff.
Herbert Hoover, Secretary of Commerce in 1922, finds infant radio facilitates news gathering, as do many others in high public office.
Tom, lay it out for me only the way you know how.
Let me break it down for you, fellas. Right. A group called Team Negative One has created a digital version of Star Wars, the original movie Star Wars that we now call A New Hope, based on a single 35mm print of the original theatrical release of the film. The reason this is such a big deal is the only official digital release of that version, like non-specialized, non-touched in any way, is on a 2006 DVD. That version is the same one used to make the Laserdisc version. It's not anamorphic. It uses compressed Dolby 2.0 audio and aggressive digital noise reduction. So this is the first good-looking version of that original theatrical version, which George Lucas has said he hates, and Team Negative One's version, therefore, is not authorized.
Would it be classified as illegal? Because I've seen some blogs say this is illegal.
Okay, here's why I don't say Team Negative One's illegal. Okay. It hasn't been dragged into court. Team Negative One hasn't been allowed to mount a fair use defense of any particular use. Copyright laws are different in all kinds of different places around the world, so it might be against the law for you to try to obtain a copy of this. It might not. I'm not going to rule. I'm not a judge.
Right.
But it's not authorized, and that's the information you need to know.
But you have a gavel. You're not a judge. What's going on?
It's true, actually. It's illegal!
Wow, he does have a gavel.
He really does. Ben, any thoughts on whether this is a... I mean, I don't know. I feel like we want this. This is a thing to preserve and have, isn't it?
Oh, as a big kind of film preservation guy, you know, I have a lot of Criterion collection. I love the look of film grain. I really want the original versions. It's funny. Maybe I'm sort of somewhere in between because I want the original versions. I'm happy for the matte lines and stuff to be cleaned up on those original prints, you know, but I just don't want any of that stupid CGI stuff. You know, the Mos Eisley stuff from the special edition is... Mm-hmm. It's weird, you know, not even Luke Skywalker's haircut has dated as badly as that stuff has from the special edition. And so, you know, the sooner we can get rid of that stuff, the better. I mean, there's been a few of these versions kicking around. There's the despecialized edition, which if you look in various parts of the internet, you might be able to find. But that one's taken from many different prints, all kinds of different stuff matted together in order to create a composite that approximates what it looked like. This is the first time the original version's been uncovered. So it's great news, I think.
Yeah, I actually, in my case, well, I have the 2006 DVD Tom mentioned, which is
I have that one too.
The crappy compressed audio and all that. I hold it dear, though, because I feel like I was never going to get a proper version of this. We'll get to this later in forecast, but maybe there's, I don't know, things on the horizon that will make this just seem like a blip on the radar. There's your tease.
And I'm with Ben on this. Like, it is a piece of film history. And I know George Lucas has said, that isn't what I wanted to release. The special edition is what I wanted to release. Except he says it like this, maybe. I don't know. And that's fine. I respect that, too, to say, look, no, if you want to see it the way Lucas intended, go watch the special edition. But I remember seeing this theatrical version as a 7-year-old, and I want to be able to relive that and as a piece of history say, okay, this is what it was like, you know, before it changed over time. It's like looking at a first edition where someone has gone and later edited things up and cleaned things up, but you can look at the first edition and see what it was like then, or even looking at a manuscript. It's the same reason people like to look at the original script of The Adventures of Luke Starkiller, because they just like to see the history of it. So I don't think this is a bad thing. I think there should be an authorized version.
I agree. And it's also, I think it's not like we're asking for the cut of Armageddon that has somebody's hand in the picture that wasn't supposed to be or something. We're talking about one of the most important films and films series of all time. It has such an impact on this business. To preserve that seems like that's a sensible thing to do. But you have to think Disney or somebody is doing something like that. Again, I'm jumping into that prediction. I don't want to do that yet, but
way to go. Scott, don't spoil forecast. Don't bring up predictions. And what is the last thing Scott does?
Both of those things. Yeah. Tell me that Deadpool. What's going on?
Yeah. All right. Deadpool's global opening weekend of $256 million is the biggest R-rated opening of all time. It's also the biggest February opening, topping last year's 50 Shades of Grey. The current all-time R-rated record holder is Mel Gibson's Passion of the Christ, which earned $371 million in the U.S. Deadpool is currently at $135 million, so it's got a ways to go to catch that. But it's breaking records, taking names.
I'm excited to see what happens Monday to see if it holds. And you know, second week is always important for movies like this. So I saw it. I really liked it. I thought it was great. I think it may actually be one of the more true to transition characters from comic book pages to film, which I think says a lot given all the great stuff we've got from Disney and others. So Ben, your take on Deadpool and its impact financially anyway so far?
Well, it was a huge surprise to me. I really enjoyed the movie. It was much like Guardians of the Galaxy. It was a property which I didn't have a lot of affinity for, certainly growing up, or certainly no nostalgia for necessarily, but no, I thought it was terrific. Certainly the funniest film I've seen in quite a while, which is not necessarily what I expected to see from a comic book movie or a Marvel comic book movie. I think the interesting thing is that, you know, a lot has been made of the R rating, you know, the R rating being responsible for its success or being a large part of its success. And it's going to be inevitable that, in fact, even today we're now talking about the next Wolverine movie being R rated. But, you know, in typical fashion, I'm pretty sure Hollywood's going to misunderstand the messages that, oh, we just need to green light a load of R rated movies and things are going to be okay. I mean, after all, we've had 3 R rated Punisher films, none of which have been particularly successful. So
sure. Yeah. I mean, the we've been talking about this a lot on a lot of our shows, but this idea that Hollywood will now leap to make a bunch of comic book movies rated R, aka, you know, Kick-Ass or things like that, I would argue they're already doing it. I would also argue that this film is less successful it would be less successful if it was PG-13, because you would be mistreating the source material in a way. So I think they just need to see it for what it is. A little bit miraculous in some ways that they pulled it off and that somebody got the rights to do it and they actually pushed the thing through after so many years of trying to do it the way that they wanted to do it. I'm a little shocked by all of that actually happening and as much fourth wall breaking that there was at the expense of Marvel and of Fox and of the director and everybody else is kind of in on and part of the joke. The fact that that got pulled off at all is a huge success. I don't think you can now go, all right, let's take every other comic book series and let's make it rated R. Maybe, Tom, just maybe Wolverine's the exception, because that's a series that is known for hyper-violent content, and they could go a little further into that realm with that next iteration of that movie.
Well, that seems like the reasonable response is to say, okay, where we would have served the story well by going into R-rated, but we kind of shied away for fear of box office hit. Now maybe we can look at Deadpool and say, no, if you do it right and you're targeting the right audience, you could still make plenty of money with an R-rated film. I think that's probably the real lesson here. I think we'll see a lot of things suddenly go R-rated for the wrong reasons, because, you know, people misinterpret results, et cetera. And I think it's like anything. Once somebody shows how to do something, you'll get people imitating it that don't work, and people imitating it that will. So yeah, I mean, would I like to see an R-rated Archie and Veronica? Probably. But it's probably not the best idea.
Probably
Wolverine seems to make more sense.
I mean, Wolverine needs is a great script, not just an R rating. And, you know, that's why Wolverine has been so poorly served, I would argue, on screen so far, is not because he's been missing an R rating.
Yeah.
And maybe the script has suffered because they've tried to avoid an R rating. Maybe not. But you're right. Like, the bigger problem is make sure you get the right script. Don't worry about the rating until after you've got a good script.
Yeah. There's an interesting point, I think, as well, with the success of Deadpool, and its success has been overwhelming, that a lot of people are forgetting, is that, you know, the last 2 years we've had record-breaking R-rated movies arriving Valentine's Day weekend, which traditionally has been a dumping ground, that sort of February period for studios. Well, this year, you know, with Valentine's Day falling on a weekend, you've got a great... people are looking for adult content, and I do think that's been a large part of the last couple of years of this R-rated success in February.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. Well, I'm just grateful it knocked 50 Shades of Grey off the all-time February number. That's fine, and they did it in quick fashion, so good job there. Don't let that thing sit there too long.
Well, something else got knocked off. Google announced it will end support for the Picasa photographic desktop application as of March 16th. Your software will continue to work. You just won't be able to download it and will not receive any updates after that date. Picasa web albums are already available in Google Photos. So if you want to make the transition to Google Photos, you can do that. Google also has a desktop uploader app at photos.google.com/apps. That'll help you add locally stored Picasa albums to Google Photos. And then starting May 1st, Google will provide an archive location for your Picasa web albums and all their specific metadata if you don't want to give those up and transfer new photos.
I don't know if it was rumors or they had already announced it, but Google Photo was gonna mow this lawn sooner or later, right? Like
nobody had to actually announce anything. Maybe people were guessing that because of all the emphasis placed on Google Photos. That certainly was a reasonable expectation, but yeah. This is the first official announcement.
You're going to miss it, Ben? You're going to miss the world of Picasa and its fantastic photo thing?
No. No, not really. I never really used Picasa. I was a Flickr guy back in the past, but now I'm a paid-up member of the sort of Apple iCloud, and pretty much everything I own or do goes into to iCloud. But I know it seems strange to me. I mean, I think it was inevitable this was going to happen, you know. But and yet Google Plus still lives.
Barely.
Yeah, hanging on by a thread. Well, and this is different than Google Plus. Google Plus was a cloud service. Picasa was both. I mean, it was a very good photo editor and cloud service that Google bought and people loved. And I think it is odd that they didn't transition it into being Google Photos, but built Google Photos separately. And a lot of people claim that Google Photos, while very nice with all its machine learning and image recognition, doesn't have as many features as Picasa. But maybe that was the point, is they wanted to build something so simpler.
Well, plus, don't they? I mean, this is part of Google's deserved or otherwise reputation of buying a thing, sort of supporting it, sometimes using it, and then oftentimes just letting it die.
They've bought so many things, and that has happened to some of them, that they get a reputation for that. I mean, people forget that they also bought DoubleClick, which turned into Google AdSense, which is a huge success. They also bought YouTube, which seems to be doing okay and also employs my wife. Like, so there's lots of things that Google buys that work great, and we forget that Google bought those things.
Yeah, that's a good point. I'll just say this in closing. How many of us here, in closing, like we're done, how many of us here think that Flickr will soon find a similar fate given everything that's happening at Yahoo right now? I'm nervous for them.
Kind of depends on who buys Yahoo. Yahoo kind of essentially put itself up for sale today.
Oh, I've missed that entire thing.
They have opened a board of independent directors to pursue strategic alignments or something.
They're very busy shutting stuff down, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Well, I'm just going to be sad. Like, Flickr was the first real photo management thing that I ever
used.
Don't
be sad yet. They haven't shut it down. Doesn't look like they're going to shut it down. And if Verizon comes in and buys Yahoo, don't expect Flickr to get shut down.
But you know me, I like to worry about things I can't control.
Well, how about worrying about this?
Okay.
Here's something for you to worry about. Rice University professor Moshe Vardy told the American Association for the Advancement of Science, quote, "We are approaching a time when machines will be able to outperform humans at almost any task."
Whoa.
He worries AI could drive unemployment to 50%. He said that virtually no human profession is totally immune and said, quote, "Are you going to bet against sex robots? I would not."
Wow. That's going someplace.
Rice University professor Moshe Vardy.
Nice. Yeah, we're approaching the time of a lot of things. I don't know if we're that close to this though. Like AI driving unemployment to 50%. Here's what usually happens. Like, I'm always reminded of when the first spreadsheet, electronic spreadsheet, 123, Lotus 123 comes out, right? And it's just one guy made it and it's on DOS and it's kind of terrible, but a few people in the accounting world get a look at it and they go, "Oh no, this literally spells the end of our days. Like, this is going to be the end of our industry. We're all getting fired. Everyone's out of here." And yes, did a bunch of people lose their jobs? Sure they did. But most of them transitioned into positions different than that one, or the number of people that were needed to sort of manage how you now interact with that data rather than a bunch of books and actual physical spreadsheets, that got transitioned to people who used to have those jobs, or new jobs were created by this. And now nobody thinks about it anymore. So I'm not so sure, man. If you start putting robots into every aspect of life, the service industry or whatever, someone's got to maintain them. Somebody's got to go in there and make sure that one's not overheating, or this one's got all the stuff it needs or whatever. We're not talking about that yet. So I don't know. 50% unemployment, come on. It's a little high.
Yeah, that sounds like one of those Donald Trump employment stats he's been throwing around.
Yeah, he likes those. Those are pretty good. Oh, today, I don't know if you guys saw today, he says... So he's going to quit. He says he uses an iPhone and he uses Samsung. I think he means Android phones. And he says unless Apple gives that data up, he's not going to use his iPhone anymore, which is fine. That's fine. Except I don't know that he knows Samsung's in Korea. That may change his mind. Anyway, bottom line is Donald Trump's an idiot. And what else? Oh, and this. But back to this thing. Yeah, I don't know, man. I just feel like these numbers are screwy, Tom. And you're the one that's always talking me off ledges about stuff like this. And this seems dumb.
Well, you were just doing the talking off a ledge until you decided to bring up presidential candidates and ruin everything. But this is. Yeah, I think you're right. Which is the 50% seems like we might lose 50% of jobs to AI, but there will be other different kinds of jobs created. And I think it was John Maynard Keynes who always purported that what happens is we create new jobs and we create new wealth. It's how we distribute that wealth, which actually Moshe talks about as well, which is more of the issue rather than whether we have tools that help make our lives easier. We could increase leisure time with this. What we have seen, though, is we don't. That we actually end up filling our leisure time with new things that we couldn't do before because we didn't have the machines to do these other things. And so the people that get caught by these kinds of transitions tend to be people who can't transition to other skills and whose profession is disrupted quickly. So let's say AI comes in and says, "We don't need anybody in a bank anymore. No more bank people." And you have several older people who've worked in a bank all their life. All they know how to do is to be a teller. That can disrupt that. And you might have some bad effects if there's quick disruption in professions like that. But overall, like long term, over the 50 years it will take to transition through this kind of stuff, I think what happens is AI starts doing certain things that we used to have to do. And now suddenly we're like, oh, well, now that I don't have to deal with that, I have time to come up with this new creative pursuit. That seems to be, to me, what happened.
And history also tells us we're going to freak out about it. So that part's,
yeah, for sure.
At least that part's happening. Anyway, I'm very excited. Bring it on. AI, 50%.
Now, you alluded to this story earlier. Tuesday night, Magistrate Sherry Pym of the U.S. District Court of Central California issued a court order for Apple to assist the U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigation in breaking the password of an iPhone 5C used by one of the San Bernardino attackers. The FBI wants Apple to provide what's called a signed image file. So it's something that would be loaded using the device firmware upgrade mode. They'd push it in like it was a firmware upgrade, run in RAM, but change the security on the 5C to allow a few things: electronic entry of multiple passwords without delays, so they don't have to have an intern sit there and type in password attempts. A deletion of the mechanism that deletes the security key after 10 attempts, so they can try as many times as they want to try to guess this password, and an elimination of the delay, which may or may not be possible, but at least they could bring it down to 80 milliseconds. Apple said in an open letter that they will oppose the request. CEO Tim Cook wrote, "Once created, the technique could be used over and over again on any number of devices, and the EFF and many others are supporting Apple's appeal."
Well, I've made my opinion on this pretty clear on the internet or on Twitter and other things, but I, for one, think this is probably a thing I would land on the Apple side for, and I hope other companies follow suit, and I don't know how this all goes. They're claiming today that they think that, you know, without getting into the politics of it, they think that Apple's doing this as a marketing ploy. That's what the State Department says.
Well, no, that is not what the Department of Justice said. That is what every headline about what the Department of Justice said claims. What the Department of Justice did today was filed a motion asking for the court to compel Apple to comply. And in that motion, they said it is obvious because of Apple's public statements that they are not going to comply. And so we're going to head and file our motion, even though they haven't filed their response yet. Apple still gets till next Friday. They gave them extra time to file their response. But the Department of Justice said, well, look, they're out there telling the public about stuff. So we're just going to file our motion to compel them to respond right now and not wait for their response. And that is sort of tantamount to accusing Apple of doing a bunch of marketing around this.
There is some freewheeling going on with headlines. Anyway, Ben, what's your hot take, man?
Yeah, I mean, I we're all expected to sort of suspect that the FBI can't be trusted in this case. But, you know, we also have to sort of believe that nice Tim Cook has got our best interests at heart here. And I don't know, I feel, is there no way that they could find an intermediary or something to come between them to kind of, I mean, I know McAfee was out there on the web earlier kind of claiming that him and his team could take it and sort of act as a third party to extract the data, and then neither the FBI nor Apple, I don't know. But it seems like a bit of a weird stalemate, and I sort of naturally fall on the side of Apple, I think, in terms of protecting data. But yeah, at the same time, I kind of feel like there must be a solution to this.
This is a matter of principle. It's about what the FBI is asking for. The FBI might not be able to get into this phone, even if they can brute force it. What the FBI is saying is, we would like Apple to remove their security protections. And Apple's saying that's a really bad precedent, because if you do it this one time, even though you're asking for it just for this one phone, then anyone anywhere in the world could say, oh, Apple's capable of doing that. And so now China can say, you know, we need you to remove security protections on these phones. And Syria can say the same thing, and Russia can say the same thing, and Turkey can say the same thing, and Pakistan can say the same thing. And it's also quite possible that other people who are nefarious non-state actors could somehow get a copy of this software, or maybe just by seeing how it works and seeing that it does work, figure out how to reverse engineer a way to get around these sorts of things.
Well, you had said on DTNS on Wednesday that Apple seems to be basing everything they're talking about on principle here. Because
they can do this.
Right.
And the FBI has made a very narrow request, saying we only are asking for you to do it for this one device, and you can do it. You don't even have to, in the request, they say, we'll hand over the phone to Apple to do this, to allow this to happen and push the DFU, push the firmware in there.
Right. So if, I guess the reason I jumped so quickly to the side of, yeah, let's do what we can to protect this data, is I like the sound. Now, maybe I'm being a sheep here, but I like the sound of somebody saying we need to watch out for your personal data. Because in so many other ways, we don't, we're out there and we're willing to let ourselves sort of hang out there. But in this one way, it'd be nice to have one safeguard. And I'm just talking about our laws. I'm talking about our country. I know it's different everywhere else. I know that that affects Apple in other ways. They may not be able to do something in China if they don't adhere to their laws, which may to us seem draconian or whatever. I get all of that. I'm just saying, for us here right now in the States, I like the idea of my phone not being easily backdoored by anyone, government or otherwise. And I like that.
And go back to your point, Ben, the FBI doesn't want to take John McAfee's help because this isn't just about getting into the phone. This is also for the FBI about the principle of being able to do this in court legally.
Right. And didn't, oh, never mind. I don't want to talk about McAfee. we could have a conversation.
Well, McAfee also says a lot of things.
Right. We could have a whole other conversation about that, but we'll stick to the headlines today, I guess.
Two big sequels are underway. Star Wars Episode 8 began filming, put out a small teaser video, along with the announcement that Benicio del Toro, Laura Dern, and Kelly Marie Tran are all in the cast for Star Wars Episode 8. And production has officially begun on Guardians of the Galaxy 2, with the announcement that Kurt Russell and Elizabeth Debicki are in the cast for that movie.
Do you see the little tiny Groot there on his shoulder there? Just hanging out?
It was awesome.
Yeah, he's got to grow. So my son saw that and he says, oh no. And I go, what? And he goes, does that mean we have to have baby Groot the whole time? Like, he's worried that it would be this cutesy joke that ran through the whole movie. And I'm like, no, I think he's probably rapidly growing, right? Like, he'll be full Groot in no time.
My son's obsessed with baby Groot, so I think he's going to be quite happy if it is.
He's
going to
be
Groot
disappointed that it's not baby Groot the whole movie if that happens. Yeah.
I hope it's not like baby Spock in that third Trek movie where he starts crying and having puberty real fast and then becomes old Spock in like an hour or whatever. We don't want that. We need a nice, fun, easy to take Groot. But yeah, I'm very stoked about all of this. It is interesting though, not in the case of Guardians, but the Star Wars Episode 8 and the new Ghostbusters trailers both got weird teasers. Well, I guess the Star Wars one is just a teaser of, hey, we're working on the next movie.
Yeah, it wasn't actually a trailer. It was just something they put up on their website that said, hey, we've started. Here's a little sneak peek.
And I guess I'm okay with that. At first, it felt like a teaser of a teaser. And the Ghostbusters one's literally that. It's a teaser of a trailer. And I don't like that when they do that. Just like, give me a trailer. You don't have to tease me about the trailer.
Isn't that what a teaser is supposed to be, though?
Is it?
Rather than an actual trailer?
I don't know. What are they? Aren't they supposed to just tease you about the movie, though? Not about a... The way they advertise it, we're like, the trailer coming at 3/3/16.
Now you know when it is. See?
We have reached kind of peak tease at this point in terms of covering this type of stuff. I mean, it's like the Predator announcement the other day, which was just a poster. You know, we're now announcing a poster. You know.
Oh my gosh, I missed that. Did we really announce a poster?
Oh, we did. Actually, that is a movie I'm incredibly excited about. Shane Black, Fred Decker, the guys who created the Monster Squad coming back together.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
And obviously Shane Black directing, which is just great news.
And didn't Shane Black, he's, if my memory serves, he's like Lethal Weapon guy. He's responsible for writing all that stuff. Am I thinking of the right guy, Shane Black?
He is. He was also in the original Predator as well.
Oh,
but,
okay. All right. Yeah, no, I'm in, man. I mean, I knew this movie was coming. I didn't know they'd announced it. Poster.
Well, see, if they had announced an announcement of the poster, you wouldn't have missed the announcement of the poster.
I guess so. Do we know, back on the Star Wars tip real quick, we don't know who Del Toro or Laura Dern or any of these new people are playing, do we?
They're not saying yet.
Okay.
No.
All right.
I mean, there was some speculation. I think that Laura Dern could be Rey's mother just because it's Laura Dern.
Oh, and, she'd be great. You know. Yeah, I could see that. She could be flashbacky stuff. Yeah.
So Laura Dern's Mara Jade?
Whoa, hold on a minute now. Will they have a scene where she runs real fast into a caged area and finds Samuel L. Jackson's arm hanging on the cage because a raptor got him? Will we see that scene? No? Okay.
Will she chase a tornado across Tatooine?
Oh, man. Now you're talking, Tom. Now you're cooking with gas, as I like to say.
Anyway, it's good to know that lots of set pick leaks and rumors of scripts and things will be coming for both these movies soon. Mm. And what is it? Guardians comes in May 2017 and Episode 8 in December 2017.
Going to be a good year next year. Everybody keeps talking about what a great year 2015 was for films. And I'm here to argue that 16 and 17 look pretty solid, too.
Yep.
Going to be good.
During the final 3 minutes of The Simpsons episode on May 15th, Homer Simpson will appear live. The show will use motion capture to map the movements of Dan Castellaneta, the voice of Homer, for both an East Coast and West Coast live broadcast. I've seen some stories say he's going to take questions. Other stories just say he'll say things to prove that it's live. So I don't know exactly what he's going to be doing, but it's a live appearance of Homer Simpson.
I'm super jazzed about that. I think that sounds really great. Like, what else are you going to do that's new under the sun for a 24-season-old show? You know,
Are you being sarcastic, Scott?
No, I actually am kind of looking forward to this. Like,
oh,
I don't know why that sounds interesting to me for some reason, because I think Castaneda, first of all, is very, he's a brilliant voice actor and a pretty good actor, just live actor. And I'm always interested in what he does. I like that guy a lot. And he is Homer. He will ever be Homer. Obviously.
I mean, I guess at this point you've got to try any gimmick to get people to care or watch that show.
Nah, you're one of those haters, aren't you? Let me tell you.
No, I'm not. Let me be clear. I'm not a hater. I was a huge fan of The Simpsons. I probably haven't watched it regularly for seven or eight years. I just wish they would sunset the series and put out a movie every three or four years. The movie was terrific.
Yeah.
You know, they could put all of their writing effort into creating a 90-minute feature every couple of years. That would be awesome.
Okay, now I'm going to agree with you. I think that would actually be a great thing to do, because at some point they do have to end this, and if they're just trying to find the perfect time, I don't know how you do that. So maybe it needs to drop out of the top 20 before they do that. I don't know. But I'll say in its defense, I still think they put out some really smart episodes, especially recently. But in the long tooth of this thing, I think you're right. And I'd love to come back, you know, every, I don't know, couple of years and revisit Springfield in a 90-minute movie. That's a great
idea. I think they should start letting the kids age. That should be their next gimmick.
Yeah, then they start. What happened?
Homer dies of a stroke. Bart's old, can't get a job.
They had a future where Bart was so big that he had to use a rag on a stick to scratch his back or something. there was an episode that actually dealt with this, and I'm not sure we want that to be their future. But yeah, like, they could have some real fun ending this thing. Certainly Futurama has proved you can have a lot of fun in your final episodes, twice in their case.
Several times, yeah.
Several times. So, yeah, I mean, look, all I'm saying is this. It's easy to hate on what The Simpsons is because of how long it's been around. But I don't, it's like old people. They're worth something. So if we get it to see, you know, Dan jumping around in a mocap suit as Homer doing his voice, it's fine. It's fine. They're worse
things. It'll never end. I'm just telling you guys both. Like, Simpsons will, the AI will keep making Simpsons long after we're dead.
Well, good. I mean, bad. I mean, I don't know what to think.
I mean, let's thank our subreddit contributors at currentgeek.subreddit.com. Right? currentgeek.reddit.com. They are this week another Jay Martin, Filthy Hacker, Captain Kipper, EFC88, Killer Charlie 12, and I Am Sci-Fi, and Free Rangers, who all submitted stories that we used in the show today. Thank you, everybody who submits stories and votes at currentgeek.reddit.com.
I completely agree. Also, while you're at it, let's say you are interested in helping the show. You're thinking to yourselves, how do I help the show stay alive? How do I help Tom and Scott pay for it? And not have to do another Patreon or have to do another weird business transaction or get a ton of sponsorship or whatever. How about this? How about you guys go over to frogpants.cratejoy.com and buy the Current Geek monthly box? What's in there? All kinds of goodies. Every month it's different. Art from me. Writing from Tom. Combinations of both those things from both of us. Calendars, stickers, mugs, stuff that you just never expect, things I don't even know about yet.
Free stuff from our guests. We're going to have a book from one of our upcoming guests.
Yeah, a free copy of a book coming to a bunch of you. You're going to have or all of you. It's going to have, what else is in that one? There's something else cool going on that I'm doing. Oh, I'm not supposed to say it. Anyway, some cool art stuff. I'll say that. Anyway, it's super rad, and I would love one. If I didn't make it all and help make it all, I would totally sign up for this. It's frogpants.cratejoy.com. It helps support the show, and it's cool stuff. So I recommend it. Go check it out.
America scores and wins.
All right, Ben, this is the part of the show where we throw a pop quiz at you. We expect you to answer questions in areas of your expertise. If you get that answer, or if you answer something right, if you get it wrong, the entire time Tom keeps score in only the way he knows how. And at the end of all this, we'll tell you how you did, kind of on average. Here's your... Oh, I guess I should have your questions up. Here we go. And they're right there, and they're right here. All right, your category is, sir... 80s slasher / horror movies.
Okay, that's good.
You're going to do this. I have a feeling you're going to nail it. All right.
Well, either that or I'm going to embarrass myself terribly.
Either way, it'll be fun for everybody.
Fun for the whole family. Here goes. Question number one. Who played Nancy Thompson in the original Nightmare on Elm Street? She's like your main victim-y girl.
Heather... Pass.
That would be incorrect. Her name was Heather Langenkamp.
Oh, he gets a point for invoking a pass. Nobody does, nobody thinks to do that. It's
yeah,
really
no one
smart.
Ever passes. That's pretty good.
Yeah.
All right.
Let's keep going.
You got a pass point. Next up, what is the name of Jason's mother in the original Friday the 13th?
Jason's mom. Her name is Jason's mom.
The answer is not Jason's mom.
I don't know the answer to that either.
Well, you know her last name, right?
Voorhees.
Yeah.
This is Voorhees.
Technically not, but it's Pamela is the correct answer. Pamela.
Pamela Voorhees. Half point for getting the last name right.
All right.
Thanks, Tom. I need your pity at this stage.
Well, you're old friends. What are friends for? What was the secondary title / subtitle of Halloween 4?
The Curse of Michael Myers.
You are so close. The Return of Michael Myers is the correct answer. Close, though.
I think 3/4 points.
All right. Fine with that. What year was the horror film Waxwork released?
I'm going to say...
I saw this for FilmSack. It is a steaming pile, that thing.
I think that stars Zach Galligan from Gremlins.
I believe you're correct. Yeah.
1988.
You are correct. Nicely done.
Well done, and an extra half point for the bonus info.
Next up, how many Nightmare on Elm Street movies were released in the 80s? So that's kind of the important point is
okay,
the 80s part. Yeah.
So A New Nightmare, which is Freddy's Dead wasn't. I'm going to go the first 5, which would be up to The Dream Child.
You are correct. 5 is correct. Part 6 was released in 91, and then everything else has come since then. Do they count the one where he's versus Jason? I guess so, right? Or was that a Friday the 13th movie? I don't know how they count that.
Sort of a hybrid, I think. It doesn't really get... if you ever get a box set with Nightmare on Elm Street, it doesn't usually have Freddy versus Jason.
Okay. But they don't count... I mean, they don't get to count each other's movie, though, right? That's not how they do it. I don't think so. Anyway, next question. Where is it? Oh, which 80s movie, horror film... featured possibly the longest scream ever. And this is an important, even though that's not very quantifiable, it is largely believed to be the longest scream in film history or in horror film history.
Widely believed.
Yeah.
Wow.
Which is very specific and very quantitative.
You want to give me a clue?
I'll give you a clue. It is a big part of the movie. In fact, most of the movie is set in a forest in a shed, like a cabin in the woods.
Oh yeah, no, it's Evil Dead. You are Evil Dead 2, actually, specifically.
You are correct, although this says, actually, maybe you're wrong. Evil Dead, the first one. It says Bruce Campbell states on the DVD commentary that a scream in this movie is the longest scream ever. And I don't know where he bases that on, but that's what Bruce Campbell says.
Wait a minute. So that's the basis of the answer is Bruce Campbell just going like, that was the longest scream ever.
Maybe, yeah.
Like, I don't know about that.
Don't trust Bruce Campbell.
I don't either. Also, I feel like you ought to get some form of points for knowing the series at all. And 2 versus 1, who cares, right? I mean, they're both good, but...
Oh, please, no.
Oh, come on. 2 versus 1 is one of the great movies of all time.
Which one? Yeah. 2 is?
2 versus 1 is an important distinction.
No,
I will
awesome.
Grant a tenth of a point for getting the franchise.
Okay. What do you think about... Where's your head at with Army of Darkness, though? Where's your top... What's the top one in all these movies?
Evil Dead 2 is the best.
Yeah.
Evil Dead 1 is the second best. Army of Darkness is third place, although I like Army of Darkness a huge amount.
It's almost like not in the same genre, though, in a weird way.
Yeah, no, it's like a Ray Harryhausen stop motion tribute.
Yeah.
Time
yeah.
travel thing. But it's a lot of fun. It definitely leans more on the slapstick comedy stuff.
Yeah.
Which those guys like.
Those movies feel like Babe, Pig in the City, and then Fury Road. That's like the George Miller equivalent.
I knew you were going to say that.
Although I will argue that Babe 2, Pig in the City is one of the great underrated movies of recent years.
I completely agree. Both those Babe movies are fantastic. George Miller.
Well, Babe in the City certainly paved the way for Fury Road.
Yeah.
Doesn't it have that kind of weird like scene inspired by Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome with the animals fighting? Yeah, it's awesome.
Oh yeah, no, there's definitely undertones there. And I would even argue there's parts of Happy Feet, his other series that had undertones. Like that guy, he was sneakily making more Mad Max movies without us knowing it and having rated G ratings on them. It's crazy. Anyway, we could talk about that all day. Let's move on to this question. What city does Jason visit in Friday the 13th, Part 8?
New York, specifically Manhattan.
You are correct. That's a great one.
Oh, and extra a quarter point for proper borough naming.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is a terrible, terrible film. In fact, he does very little of actually killing or even doing anything in Manhattan. Most of the film is set on a boat with him traveling to Manhattan.
He does a lot of sightseeing. He kind of does what most people do the first time they go.
Love that one, but only because it's so bad. It's just real. It's super dumb. And also, you answered it exactly word for word to the answer that is written here. It says New York City, specifically Manhattan.
So, oh, wow. Yeah. So specific word order bonus point.
Nice job. You have one final answer or one final question. This is your eighth and final question. How many short stories compose the horror anthology film Creepshow? So the anthology film Creepshow, how many short stories make up that film?
Three short stories, four including the wraparound story.
You are? It says five. Now, I don't have verification independently of this. Other than what this sheet says, which was created by a friend of the program, Iceworm, who does all our questions. So I have no way to say which, if you're right or wrong.
There's the one with Stephen King turning into a big pile of moss.
Yeah,
there's like the one with E.G. Marshall where cockroaches come out of his mouth.
Yeah. Ugh.
There's the one with Leslie Nielsen with his head buried in sand on the beach. and I'm trying to remember what the other stories are in that.
There must have been more, but you're right on those other three.
Like, yeah, it is five stories.
Yeah, the roach one I could never get out of my head, and Stephen King as a plant, basically a chia pet, that freaked me out. But the others I don't remember. So we'll for now we say five. If anyone wants to refute it, you let us know. CurrentGeek@gmail.com. All right, that's your questions, Tom. Add them up. How did he do?
Out of the eight questions, 7.6 points.
That's a fantastic score. Congratulations. I think. Isn't that good?
I feel like I let myself down a little on the early ones there, but
you did fine.
Rallied, though. You rallied hard.
You totally did rally hard. Let's rally right into forecast.
The future promises even more startling things to come.
Forecast is a segment where we try to predict the future in technology, culture, or otherwise. And sometimes we pick them. Sometimes our guests do. And today, Ben did. Ben, why don't you lay out what you think about your forecast today?
Okay, I am predicting that Disney will put out the original theatrical unspecial editions of the original Star Wars trilogy by the end of 2016.
Whoa, that's this year. That'll be interesting.
Yes, it's very near future.
There are rumors to this effect anyway. It seems like a no-brainer. Like, I have a hard time arguing with this logic. I think it's just totally going to happen because they know that there's at least a segment of the viewing population that is clamoring for this. So why wouldn't it behoove Disney? Because they don't have the same resistance George might to not liking his original work or whatever. They don't care.
There was nonsense circulating around. They'd edited the original negatives and all this kind of stuff, which I still don't believe at all. But you only have to go and look at certain torrent websites and see how many cedars those unofficial versions or bootlegs of those original movies have to know that this is a sure thing for Disney.
So really they were going to, the word was that he went and edited the original negatives.
The official story, Lucas has said this. Now, whether he's lying or not is the question. And I kind of side with Ben, like it seems unlikely. Lucas has said, I edited the original negatives. There is no original negative of that theatrical release anymore.
Wow. So wait, but that doesn't mean he just threw them away. I always thought he just threw them away. They were old and ratty and said, that's it. And now we have this digital thing that I made and now I don't care about the old ones. I didn't realize he claimed to actually edit the original negatives and stuff. That seems crazy. Not negatives. What's it called? Is it negatives? No.
Yeah. No, the negatives of the original film.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So why would... I'm struggling with this, but it doesn't make any sense to me. That's like saying...
No, it makes no sense, particularly as those special editions are largely were largely created in a digital environment.
Yeah, so you have a big digital remaster of everything anyway now. What would be your motivation to then say, okay, we've got the thing we're going to put in the theater. Let's all take a couple of months and go back and edit this all into a negative. Like, that's a major job. For no reason.
But even if they didn't, I mean, they could do a similar job to what these guys have done in the story we mentioned earlier, where you just take a theatrical print and restore it to its original, you know, clean up the scratches and stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, all three of us are getting it, right? Like, if they do this, I mean.
I kind of think they'll wait until episode 9 is out. I kind of think when episode 9 comes to DVD or whatever we're doing by then, maybe it's a USB stick, that's when they'll say, and now there's a box set that has every single movie and every single version of every movie available 1 through 9.
Interesting. But not before they do, let's see, where are we? We just did 7. This is going to be 8 and 9. So you think at the end of 9, so like 2000 and...
Yeah, once 9 is available for purchase, that's when they put out the complete Star Wars box set of all special edition versions, theatrical releases, everything.
How many times does Greedo shoot in that version?
Oh my gosh, you can't count. It's an infinite number of times.
Yeah, infinite Greedos. Okay, here's the other question then. Can they not do it piecemeal? Can they go New Hope this year? Can they go Empire next year? Jedi the next year? Just to kind of spread it out and then do a box set?
I think Tom's right. They'll put them out together.
Yeah. You don't think they'll try to get us twice though? Like sell it to us individually? I mean, they've already gotten us like 4 times in the past. Like one more time individually and then one more time in a giant box set. You don't think they'll go for that?
Oh, no. I mean, I think they did that. They sold the first 6 as a box set prior to episode 7 coming out. So this will be, then they're going to get everybody to buy each individual movie as it comes out. And then they'll put out a box set to get you to buy all of them again.
All right. And then on to Indiana Jones and doing that all over again as well. So that'll be good. Thanks, Disney. Good prediction. If you guys like that prediction or have one of your own, you can always email those in, currentgeek@gmail.com. Same self-same email address can be used to send us email address or email questions like this one. We got one from, it's Thornblower. It's in the body of the message. Dear Tom and Scott and guest, that would be you, Ben. Someone is sawing something in half in my house. I don't know if anyone can hear
probably that. Thornblower. He's probably blowing thorns.
Thornblower here, he says, with a prediction. By 2020, I guess he's got a forecast of his own. By 2020, there will be a remake of the Matrix trilogy, either out or on the way. That seems about the right timing for such a thing, don't you think? Says Thornblower. Yeah, I always kind of wonder when that will get reapproached. It's been long enough, I think. I don't know, since the last one, maybe not, but 99 for the original. You'd think that by now, at the very least, we would have heard more about a Matrix TV show or more animated things or something in that universe. To have it sort of not do anything for this long is weird to me. Ben, any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's probably inevitable seeing as how much remaking and rebooting we see. I still haven't seen the third Matrix movie. I hated the second one so much that I actually refused to go and see the third one. I still haven't seen it to this very day.
Well, it's worse than the second, so if that helps you feel better.
Great. I'll seek that out as soon as possible. But I actually like the Wachowskis a lot, and I mean, I'll make a case even for Jupiter Ascending as being a really interesting film. But I don't know. I hope they're involved because and I hope they don't touch the sequels and just go, if they do remake it or they do revisit it, it's just the original movie, because that movie was never intended to be a trilogy. It feels to this day, and I know they claim that they were planning it out as a trilogy, it definitely feels like it was a great movie that was turned into or forced into a trilogy.
It's still one of those movies that feels like a perfect movie in a weird way. Like I don't know what else to compare it to, except for maybe like Empire Strikes Back, that Raiders of the Lost Ark, I would put in that category. Like, I have a list of movies I think are kind of perfect, and The Matrix is always in that place, and the sequels are so bad that I don't even consider them part of it. And I'm not saying that from some like hipster point of view. I really just don't. They feel disjointed and unconnected to me. But I think I'd be okay with them saying it's time to revisit that. At the very least, what would be wrong with like FX or somebody saying we're going to do a new, you know, series based on the Matrix universe, different characters.
As bad as the sequels were, I would rather see that. I would rather see an extension of the universe. Mm-hmm. Like let's explore a part of the universe that's actually interesting, you know, and maybe like uncanonize the sequels somehow and redo that. But I, for some reason, I don't want to see the Matrix done again. I feel like it's kind of like what you're saying, Scott. It's so good as it is. It's like, you know, I don't need Casablanca to be remade either. And I'm not saying The Matrix is as good as Casablanca, but it's that kind of feeling I get, which is like, no, just leave it leave it as it is. There's no reason to remake The Matrix.
Yeah, maybe they don't need to do that. But make a show or something. Or, you know, The Animatrix gave me big hope because not only did it showcase a bunch of really talented animators and writers, but it just gave us a chance to see that world from all these different perspectives. They had timelines that were set in feudal Japan, yet it's still people in pods experiencing their lives and fighting, you know, fighting the machines then. Like, you can do things in that world that they haven't even touched on in the films that The Animatrix made me go, ooh, this is an interesting take on this, or whatever. The skateboarding kid in high school was a really cool one. Like, that's an awesome, if people haven't seen that recently, you should go back and watch it. Really, really, really good. And yeah, I'd be all for this. So Thornblower, we like your idea, but only if it's TV. So there you go. Thanks for the email. Emails come to us at currentgeek@gmail.com. You can also leave us voicemail feedback at 801-471-0462. Before we head out of here, we need to know where people can find more Ben. So Ben, where can they find you? What's going on? Tell us about your shows. Anything else you want people to know about? Well, as is just my luck, the internet went out right when I asked that question, which is super annoying and lame because not only was he a great guest, but, you know, would have been nice to let him have a chance to talk about his cool stuff that he has going on. We're going to have him back. Of course, Tom's not here either because the internet's down at the moment. I don't know what happened. There's some construction next door. I hope that's not what's going on. We will see in the morning, probably. Anyway, if you want to find more of Ben Howard, look for him on Twitter. I can tell you his Twitter account. It is, here it is. It is MondoBen. So it's MondoBen. And you can find out about his podcast and everything else he has going on by following him there. Of course, Tom at Ace Detect, me at Scott Johnson, this show at currentgeek@gmail.com. What else? Don't forget to support us, love us, be here. Come on back next week. Internet should be back. That'll be good, right? For me, for Tom, and for our guest. We'll see you next week.
Hi, and welcome back to Legal Geek. This week, we investigate the immediate effects of Justice Antonin Scalia's passing away on the Supreme Court in this 2016 term and beyond. News broke last weekend that the senior-most member of the Supreme Court, Justice Scalia, had passed away of heart failure on a hunting trip in Texas. Scalia had served on the court since confirmation in 1986. This will cause the first lineup change of the court since the retirements of David Souter and John Paul Stevens in 2009 and 2010. So what are the effects of Scalia's death? Let's start with the 2016 term, which must now proceed with the remaining eight justices. With four reliable liberals, three reliable conservatives, and one swing vote among the eight remaining justices, there will be many opportunities for 4-4 ties this term. When that occurs, the Supreme Court issues a short per curiam opinion upholding the ruling of the lower court. These issues may be presented once again in other jurisdictions and appeals, so all hope is not lost for the losing side to be granted certiorari again. It will just take longer to reach a full Supreme Court panel and a final decision. But a term that was loaded with huge issues and cases will now unfortunately fizzle on many of these big issues. Moving forward, the other important issue will be how and when Scalia will be replaced. The president has sole power to nominate a replacement, but his choice must be confirmed by the U.S. Senate. Given that this is a contentious election year, and the Senate having a strong Republican majority, this could shape up to be a long battle of delay. It will be interesting to see if President Obama nominates a more moderate justice than his first two a few years ago, in an effort to avoid this gridlock. Although don't expect any strong conservative or constitutional originalists like Scalia to be the replacement. Instead, the court will take a different course with a new lineup, and a new voice in the room could challenge the current justices in new and different ways. If Obama adds a third justice to the court, then this will likely mark a true shift from a couple decades of general conservatism to the potential for a liberal-leaning court for the next few years. That could bring some interesting shifts in law and policy. If the court is stifled for a replacement for a staggering 10-plus months to wait on the new president, then the gridlock in Washington will jeopardize some cases on the 2017 docket as well. The bottom line is, the Supreme Court lost a great mind this week. Even if you strongly disagreed with Justice Scalia, His legacy over three decades in the highest court will stand as one filled with strong judicial principles and well-reasoned opinions and dissents that raised the game of all justices on the court along with him. Thanks for listening. Please provide feedback and segment suggestions to me on Twitter at BuckeyeFitzy.
This show is part of the Frog Pants Network. Get more at frogpants.com.